welcome to the National Press Club to this Lowy Institute event to launch the 2019 Lowy Institute Asia Power Index. I'm Sam Roggeveen. I'm Director of the International Security Program at the Lowy Institute. I'm also the Lowy Institute's sole representative here in Canberra. With me on the stage, Hervé Lemayeur and Bonnie Blay, together responsible for the digital wonder that we're going to explore over the next hour. I want to acknowledge two Lowy Institute board members in the audience, Penny Wensley and Angus Houston. Welcome. Bonnie and Hervé have been travelling the country a little bit over the last few days, holding events like this one to launch the Asian Power Index for 2019. And this morning, Bonnie, when you arrived in Canberra, you tweeted a picture out from the plane, and I responded on Twitter that welcome to the most powerful city in Australia, Canberra. Some of you might remember, actually, in the late 90s, there was a minor disaster in ACT local government when they got it into their heads that it was a good idea to put a new slogan on the number plates. Does anyone remember what that was? Feel the power of Canberra. So here we are finally in, I think, the spiritual home of the Asian Power Index, Canberra. So the Asia Power Index, I think, really is a product of its time. Perhaps even 10 years ago, but certainly 20 years ago, it would have seemed a little odd, maybe even anachronistic, to have perhaps even redundant to have talked about, comparing national power throughout Asia. After all, power in that period, particularly in the 90s, was so preponderant, so concentrated on the United States. But of course, we live in a very different world now. We live in an Asia of competition, great power competition here in Asia. So in 2018, the Lowy Institute launched the first attempt really of any organisation to systematically measure national power in Asia. And we did it in the form of a digital interactive tool that we're going to look at and examine this evening. It's important to stress that that digital tool is open for all of you to look at via the Lowy Institute's website. And more importantly, you can't just look at it. You can also manipulate it any way you want to. So the results that Hervé is going to talk about in a moment are, it's important to stress, are our interpretation. We think an authoritative interpretation of the data, but you can manipulate that data and you can figure out for yourself. If you feel that, for instance, military power has been overstated, you turn the dial down on that measure and you can, explore the data from any perspective you wish. That is, I think, the beauty and the strength of this incredible digital tool that we've created here. So what I'd like to do is begin by allowing Hervé just to take a few moments to summarise the big conclusions from the 2019 version of the Power Index. So Hervé, please, if you'd get us started.
Thanks very much, Sam. I'm going to move up to the podium. I've got a few slides. But I thought that, let's situate this in this moment in historical perspective. And it's worthwhile just taking a step back and considering how quickly the global distribution of economic power has changed in two-plus decades. In 1995, the five largest economies globally were the United States, followed by four of its treaty allies. And four of the top five global economies were transatlantic. The center of the world was somewhere in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. And as we move, as we progress from 1995, in very quick order, we see how quickly Asia's economic transformation has changed the way the world works politically and strategically. China went from an economy about the size of Spain to surpassing Germany and France in the mid-2000s. By 2009, became the second largest economy globally, surpassing Japan. India, a bit more of a laggard, but has experienced its own economic miracle of sorts in the last few years, to such an extent that the IMF predicts that by 2023, which is really tomorrow, it's in the blink of an eye, India will be the fifth largest economy globally. So that's the region in global perspective. And that's just looking at GDP at market exchange rates. Because if you consider GDP at purchasing power parity, which is to say it's cheaper to build skyscrapers or to pay the wages of soldiers in India and China than it is in the US, then you have to consider the fact that China is already larger than the US, about a third larger in terms of its economic scale. India is the third largest economy at purchasing power parity globally, and Indonesia is about the size of Germany at purchasing power parity. So that's just how quickly things have changed in the last 3 decades. Now, we don't just look at economic resources. We undertake a comprehensive exercise whereby we look at not just what countries have, but we also look at what countries do with what they have. It's nice to have a large economy, but you need to be investing in strategically pivotal countries. It's nice to have a large and powerful military, but you need to be investing in defense diplomacy. So across the board, we have 126 indicators, 30,000 data points that we aggregate, and we divide those into 8 thematic measures of power. The first is economic resources, which is GDP, but we've also looked at connectivity, technology, the role of currencies and sanctions. The second is military capability. The third is resilience, which is the capacity of states to withstand threats to their stability, real or potential threats to their stability. Keeping in mind that that is a prerequisite for countries to project their interests abroad, but more importantly, in the absence of resilience, countries become more vulnerable to foreign influence. Then we have future resources, where we look at the projected distribution of military, demographic, economic resources. And we think that's important because it already informs perceptions of power today. We don't just look at China as it's constituted today, but we consider the fact that China may even be more powerful, more economically influential in 20 years' time. And then, as I say, it's not just what countries have in terms of their resources and capabilities. We also assess countries in terms of their influence within our region. And this is where the Asia Power Index becomes gets its geographical focus. We're looking at how countries interact with every other country and territory within Asia, and we consider that in terms of their their diplomatic networks, in terms of their economic diplomacy, in terms of their defense initiatives, their defense networks and diplomacy, in terms of their cultural influence. So once we aggregate all of those variables, we get to an understanding of the distribution of power that looks something like this. I'll get to the website in a minute, but what I really want to focus on here is that the US remains the dominant power, but its power is stable. It's unchanged. Whereas every other country in aquamarine, 14 out of 25 countries and territories that we look at, register positive movement in their assessments of, or in our assessment of their power. That is to say, everyone is becoming more powerful in relation to the top performer, in relation to the United States. The U.S.'s unipolarity, its exceptionalism, is being eroded, not just by China, but in fact by the rise of an entire region. And I think that's an important distinction to make. Why? Because the Indo-Pacific ecosystem is created and sustained by many more actors than just the U.S. and China. And that's why we go as far west as Pakistan, as far north as Russia, as far into the Pacific as New Zealand and Australia. And I think I want to make 3 big points, which we can talk more about in the discussion. But one is that it's not just the distribution of power that we are looking at and how that's changing. In fact, the nature of power and the nature of international order is changing. We are moving into a new era of great power relations from an open and consensual world order that has held since the fall of the Cold War back to something that's defined by competition and zero-sum politics between the two largest players, that is China and the United States. Now, I think that has 3 big implications. The first is that under most scenarios, short of war, I don't think the U.S. will be able to halt the narrowing power differential between itself and China. And if anything, I think the Trump administration has succeeded in accelerating the leveling between the U.S. and China by focusing on renegotiating free trade agreements, by focusing on leveling trade balances one country at a time. That sort of strategy has not kept pace with China's economic soft power. Secondly, I think globalization will continue to involve the United States and China, but less and less the two together. We're talking about decoupling between the world's two largest economies, and that means a more hazardous variant of globalization for the rest of us, but it doesn't necessarily mean the end of globalization. I think the U.S. and China will do less with each other, but most countries will continue to engage with China and the U.S. on an economic level. And the third big point I want to make is that that is a very different set of circumstances to the last Cold War, where we could speak about a mutually exclusive spheres of influence, where there were two neatly divided camps, where security alliances and economic alliances were intermeshed. I think here we're dealing with much more gray space. This is fluid. And within that fluidity, middle powers actually become more important, more crucial in determining the overall balance of power. And that's a slightly counterintuitive finding, but it is not just a two-horse race. In fact, the more that U.S. and China are at loggerheads, the more space is opened up for creativity and initiative by third players. So I think let's move to the actual website, which is slightly more exciting. And I want to make some key points about the results. I mean, obviously with 30,000 points, data points, we could be talking for hours. But the first is that we need to nuance China's rise a little bit. I think the biggest challenger to China's rise is not necessarily the United States, but itself. And it is facing a series of internal and external challenges that we're picking up in the data. Its hard power remains hobbled by the fact that 11 of its neighbors have either unresolved boundary disputes with China or legacies of interstate conflicts that go back for decades with China. And that is a source of immense distrust of China's role and its intentions. Even where China does best, which is in terms of its economic relationships in the region, we're witnessing, I think, in the last 12 months, some interesting degrees of opposition towards the Belt and Road Initiative. Countries as diverse as Malaysia and Myanmar, by no means allies of the United States, have nevertheless succeeded in renegotiating the terms of their big flagship Belt and Road Initiative projects in favor of the borrower. And again, I think I would make the point that the leverage here in these relationships exists on both ends. It is also the smaller players who have power here. Secondly, and I think probably more concerning for China, is that it faces demographic decline. In less than 30 years, China's working age population will decline by 158 million people. That is as a result of the aging population of China. And that presages all forms of structural, social, political challenges, I think, for the Communist Party. And it also means that in terms of the relativities in Asia, by mid-century, India will be 20% larger demographically than China. So that brings us to India, which is ranked fourth. India is a major power, but it's a bit of an underachiever in the sense that we find that Narendra Modi's Act East policy has run out of steam. It doesn't have enough economic muscle power. And I don't think New Delhi will ever have the control over the allocation of economic resources that's been intrinsic to China's economic diplomacy. In other words, India will not be the next China. But India doesn't need to be the next China to present a serious threat to China's rise. The relativities, I mean, India's growth will mean that the relativities of China's dominance in our region will start chipping away in much the same way that the relativities of the U.S.'s dominance is now being chipped away by the rise of China. So just consider that as the next great game in Asia. Japan is very close to India. It's actually just ahead of India and is an absolute overachiever in our results. That is to say that it outranks the United States in terms of our assessment of its diplomatic influence in our region. And that's as a result of the premiership of Shinzo Abe having resuscitated the multilateral trading architecture under the guise of the Trans-Pacific Partnership minus America. But also the fact that Japan considers to be, or it continues to be, the largest investor in Southeast Asia, 1.5 times more overall investment over the last 10 years than China in Southeast Asia. That's often forgotten in the headlines. So Japan has become the leader of the liberal order in Asia, and that's another rather controversial finding. Now, beyond that major power status, I just want to make a few more points. One is that North Korea has made some surprising inroads over the last 12 months, albeit coming from a low base. It was ranked 17th last year. This year it's ranked 16th. And there's no question that summit diplomacy, ostensibly on an equal level playing field as the United States, has helped to elevate and to partly normalize North Korea's diplomatic standing in our region. Nevertheless, it remains a debilitated power. Its economy is smaller than Laos, even though Laos has a quarter of the population of North Korea. So we have to keep that in mind. It's an asymmetric power. Finally, Taiwan is another very interesting result, simply because it is the only middle power that registered a downward shift in its in our assessment of its overall power. And that's rather concerning. It's lost three more diplomatic allies in the last 3 years, or three embassies, three countries that previously recognized it as the main China. And it is increasingly isolated. But I would argue it remains crucial to the overall balance of power in Asia. Insofar as an autonomous territory is still capable of exercising its own defense policy, its own foreign policy, that continues to be an enormous check on China's ambitions to become a fully-fledged maritime power. We'll discuss Australia in a minute during the discussion, but I just wanted to give you an overall sense of where we stand in the region in terms of the most remarkable results. So thanks very much.
Thank you, Hervé. Take a seat. And I realised I erred a moment ago in the introductions by not mentioning that you got your titles, because I mentioned my own but then neglected to tell the audience here that, Hervé, you are the director of the Asian Power and Diplomacy Program at the Lowy Institute, and Bonnie, a research fellow in the Asian Power and Diplomacy Program. And as I said, together, these guys are responsible for this incredible digital tool. So, Hervé, you just, I think, alluded to the first question I wanted to ask. And I should say that I'll just begin with a few questions, but then open it up. So please, prepare your questions now. Hervé, tell us a little bit more about Australia's place. Its ranking, and what shifted over the last 12 months in particular?
Yeah. So I think Australia's power overall is stable. We're ranked seventh, just behind South Korea, so we're an integral, significant player within the Indo-Pacific region. And it's interesting how the narrative was somewhat changed in the media coverage of the index. So
use terms like flatlining.
That's planting. Right. So stable turned into Australia's power is flat, and then that turned into Australia's power is flatlining. And I think that gives it a very different meaning. I think it's actually noteworthy that Australia's power is stable, given the narrative is that we're in relative decline. I don't think we're in relative decline at all. In fact, we're registering upward trends in terms of our military capability, our signature capabilities in particular. We're making pronounced investments. We're also registering an upward trend and a sort of move up in one ranking in economic relationships, partly as a result of also being a member of the TPP-11. The one area where there was an upset, we lost one ranking within our assessment of diplomatic influence, where we're now behind Indonesia for 2019. And it seems that's related to the leadership churn that we experienced in 2018 when we asked a representative sample of policymakers and experts in the region to rate the efficacy of leaders and governments to pursue their interests abroad. Australia has done less well than it did the year previous, and we think that's something to do with the political instability. Now, there's no question that having had five prime ministers in 6 years somewhat compromises our ability to form lasting relationships with counterparts. But I would argue that actually we need to qualify that by saying that's a politically reversible trend. That's not a systemic trend. And in fact, I think Scott Morrison now has an opportunity to level or stabilize Australia's fluctuating diplomatic influence. We're also ranked second in defense networks, which I think is a reflection not only of the depth of the US alliance, but increasingly what we're doing in terms of our investment in non-allied regional partnerships. And we measure the vitality of those relationships by looking at joint training exercises, by looking at defense dialogues, arms transfers, joint operations, and the like. So we can actually start tracking how the region at large is, in some sense, I think, organizing itself or organizing a strategic counterweight to the rise of China as a military power.
Now, Bonnie, let me bring you into the conversation now. The beauty of this wonderful digital tool that we have here is that it's grounded in so much data. And so if you could begin by telling us a little bit how this index is organized, how we measure power, what that entails, and whether the methodology that you use to measure power has evolved since we first released this in 2018.
Yeah, certainly. So as Hervé already mentioned, we have 8 core measures of power, but that's really just the tip of the iceberg. So these consist of 30 sub-measures, which all tell different stories in their own right. And we have a whole 126 indicators this year, so that's 12 new ones that we've also added. And that was off the basis of lots of feedback we got and lots of further thinking and new data becoming available and so on. So it's a really, it's an iterative process that we keep working on. And 40% of the data is actually primary research as well. So there's new data here that we haven't seen put together before in this sort of in this way. So there's lots of new findings coming through from that as well. So in terms of the new indicators we looked at, Hervé mentioned Australia and Australia's performance. One of the new indicators we thought would be worth adding was looking at refined fuel imports. So yes, Australia is a net energy exporter, but it actually ranks last for its imports of refined fuel. So I think that's quite a critical nuance to bring in there. Another new one we've brought in is UN voting patterns. So here we're asking ourselves, how do countries behave on the multilateral level? And we find middle powers band together more closely than the great powers. We also look at new indicators like electricity generation from renewables. And the numbers here are quite staggering. So China produces 2.5 times the electricity from renewables that China, that the US does, sorry, and 45 times what Australia produces. So I was quite taken aback by those numbers when we first got that data. And then we've got one new qualitative indicator as well. So 13 of the 126 are qualitative, and this year we added one looking at strategic ambitions. So this means you know, you might have as a country a certain amount of power, but is there a willingness to use that power to achieve the outcomes that you want and that work in your interest? And then you mentioned as well in your introduction the website. So the website was a large part of what we spent the last 2 years working on, and it was really important to us that it maximized transparency and also interactivity with all our results. And the idea here is to allow users to really critically engage with our assumptions. Mm-hmm. So not only do we make our assumptions quite bare, but we also ask users, we invite users to make their own assumptions and to challenge those. So that's where we have the weightings calculator, which you already mentioned. So here you can manipulate all 8 key measures of power, decide which elements you think are most important. And in a new innovation this year, we actually allow users to change every single sub-measure if they choose to. So with technology, sort of the buzzword of the moment when it comes to the trade war with US, and China, if technology you think is the sort of next critical thing to be watching, you can ramp up that weighting and see how the rankings recalibrate on that basis. One more thing I just want to quickly briefly touch on the website is something that we call the influence maps. So the frustration as the researchers behind this is that we have this really incredibly rich, nuanced data, and we need to flat pack it into an IKEA-worthy final ranking. And we miss a lot of the sort of detail and the texture that is actually quite telling about how countries perform. And so that's where we have these influence maps. And so the influence maps allow you to look at all the bilateral data between all 25 countries. So you can imagine why we have over 30,000 data points. and here you can see, for example, from China's perspective, which countries are most influential to China and vice versa, where is China influential? And we do this across dozens of metrics. So we're looking at trade, we're looking at investment, we also look at arms transfers, we look at tourism, migration, media influence, UN voting alignment. So it is completely a very rich source of analysis in its own right. And that's not even the sort of index proper. So there's lots to get into tonight.
Yeah, indeed. Well, and we can't, let me stay with you, Bonnie, because we can't get very far in this conversation without talking about China. We just heard Hervé discuss the relativities of power changing in the region, with the gap narrowing between the United States and China. We put that down largely to China's economic growth and also its military modernization, but that's not all there is. Of course, famously, we have the Belt and Road Initiative, this rollout, massive rollout of infrastructure spending around not just Asia, but around the world. Also, the growth of Chinese diplomacy around around Asia, media reach as well. So help us dig into the data then behind this huge shift relative power between the United States and China.
Yes, so we hear a lot of narratives being thrown around China, lots of generalizations about how it's investing in these strategies to boost its influence in Asia. And I ask myself, what does that mean? So if we take a few examples, you can kind of start to put a more sort of granular picture together, which tells a sort of bigger story as well. So I mentioned earlier UN voting alignment. So here we ask ourselves, how many times in the last year has another country in the region voted yes, yes with China, or no, no, or abstain? So how often have they voted in alignment with China? And the answer is, on average, 81% of the time. So that's pretty decent. In contrast, average alignment with the US was only at 26%. So it is something of a reluctant patron of the UN by comparison. But if you look at the middle powers, and I already alluded to this earlier, their alignment with the region is much higher at the UN. And then we can use these influence maps to actually track which countries are voting in alignment with China. And no surprise, it's its historical partners. It tends to be North Korea and Russia, with a really high alignment at the UN at 90% and 86% respectively. But then you look at Southeast Asia, and the alignment with China is much lower at the UN. And that's quite a surprising finding, because that's where we hear lots of stories of sort of growing influence, lots of BRI initiatives, and so on. So there we see quite an absence of sway as it currently stands on this sort of multilateral platform. You can also flip it on its head and ask, where is China aligning itself at the UN? So who is it partnering up with, and who is it trying to match its interests with? And that tends to be those countries which are quite strategically relevant to China. So that is North Korea, Pakistan, Cambodia, and Vietnam as well. So you can kind of look at it from the reverse side as well, China trying to win favors through tactical voting. Just another example while I'm here, you'll have to stop me eventually, but the media patterns are fascinating. So what we do here, this is quite a novel technique that we developed a year ago, and we use internet search trends to assess how information flows are moving through Asia. And this is important because where you get your news from determines how you see the world. And here we looked at four different sources of media and use proxies for each. So we look at newspapers, television broadcasters, radio broadcasters, and news agencies. And in all categories, the U.S. is uncontested. It is by far and away the leader when it comes to Asia's media landscape. And China is pretty far off. It's actually in 10th place for its newspapers, in 10th place for its television broadcaster, and only in 8th place for its radio broadcaster. And that's in spite of billions of investments into broadening its media reach. So, you know, opening foreign bureaus, training up journalists in languages. It's invested almost $7 billion since 2009 in these initiatives. Like, it rebranded the CCTV to be CGTN. And we aren't seeing that pay dividends yet. But when you look at its news agency, Xinhua, it actually comes in second place after the U.S.'s Associated Press. So I think that's quite a significant finding. It still has about half the popularity in the region, but it is it is making inroads on that front. And then you can see on this map, which Hervé's just pulled up, which countries are interested in Xinhua. It tends to be Laos, Myanmar, and Mongolia. So now I know that these countries are consuming information from Chinese news sources. And you can basically start to build a much more comprehensive picture of influence and where China's making inroads and where it isn't as well, to the surprise of some people. And I think this whole influence map in general makes quite a compelling case for why we should take a more data-driven approach when we talk about China, rather than painting it in sort of broader brushstrokes.
Yep. Hervé, I want to ask you about one specific aspect of hard power. Over the last week or so, I'm sure many of you will have noticed that we've seen the launch of a new debate in Australia on nuclear weapons, thanks to Hugh White and his book on Australian defence policy. which I think it's fair to say tentatively presents the case that Australia may need nuclear weapons at some time in the future. You mentioned in your introductory remarks North Korea, and the shorthand I've always used when I've written about North Korea is that it has an economy roughly the size of Laos. I think that's still pretty much true. And yet it comes out in the Asia Power Index as a middle power. And I think that's largely because of nuclear weapons. So help us to understand a little bit about what nuclear weapons mean for a nation and what it, you know, what it says about its about its hard power and its overall influence in the international system.
Yeah, that's a tough question. I think look, there's no question that North Korea does better than it would otherwise without nuclear weapons. Although, does it? I mean, without nuclear weapons, there wouldn't be an international sanctions regime. Perhaps its economy wouldn't be as small as Laos. It would be much more branched into the multilateral architecture. It would have broad-based influence as opposed to asymmetric power in the form of its nuclear deterrent. But I think it is actually a very relevant question that suddenly the nuclear debate should rear its head again. After a period of I think basically dormant discussion on the validity of nuclear weapons, we actually think nuclear weapons qualifies under resilience. What it does is, I mean, we're assuming that most countries are still rational and that they wouldn't use nuclear weapons because at the moment that North Korea decides to push the button, it's inviting its own annihilation as in retribution. So nuclear weapons serves as a deterrent. And it serves as a deterrent against larger powers. And I think that's exactly what Hewitt has in mind when he at least invites us to entertain the question. I mean, he's not advocating that we should actually go all the way, but he's saying it's an important question. And I think that is reflective of a certain degree of strategic anxiety. North Korea has quite a big degree of strategic anxiety, and maybe we're also moving in a similar direction. But I would qualify that by saying, actually, Australia is spoiled. You know, I'm a Belgian by origin. We know what it's like to live with strategic anxiety. Larger neighbors know the battlefield of Europe for centuries. And I would say that Australia has an exceptional state of affairs, Australia and New Zealand, in terms of being the only countries in Asia, and perhaps globally, that are surrounded by friends and fish. You know, there's no boundary disputes to speak of. I mean, you only have to speak to the Vietnamese to realize what their conundrum is, and they've been living under that situation for centuries. So in a way, we're becoming a more normal country in Australia, and we need to face up to the challenge in the South Pacific. We need to face up to the rise of China and its potential military ambitions. But we shouldn't overreact either. And I think there is a danger of overreaction. And I think nuclear weapons only gets you so far before you start, well, you've got to then think, if we deserve nuclear weapons, and certainly the Vietnamese do, they're much closer to the threat. Should the Taiwanese, should the Japanese, should the South Koreans? And before you know it, you're dealing with a mass proliferation threat, which undermines all of our security.
And will make the Asia Power Index look very different.
That's right.
Now, before I open it up to the floor, Bonnie, one final question for you. Aside from the overall power rankings, the Power Index this year also has another set of findings called the power gap. So can you tell us a little bit more about that, explain that, and how the results have changed from last year?
Yeah, sure. So you can forget everything you just learned about the overall power rankings. This is a whole secondary analysis that we do, and it's really complementary to those results we've already discussed. And it's called the power gap. So what we do here is we take the results for each country from those first four resources measures, so your economic resources, your military capability, your resilience, and your future resources. And you compare that to how a country performs under the four influence measures, so diplomatic, cultural, defense networks, and economic relationships. And the idea is that you can assume that a country with a certain number of resources has an approximately equivalent amount of influence in the region, in Asia. However, that's not quite the case. And we can plot this out on the graph, which you can see. Some countries are overachievers, so their influence is unexpectedly high considering their resources, and other countries are underachievers. And some countries fall quite neatly on the line. So if we look at the two superpowers in our index, US and China, you'll notice they sit right at the top on the line, more or less. Both of them them underachievers. But what's interesting is, having done this for a second year in a row, we now know that last year, US was a marginal overachiever. And it's ever so slightly dipped down into the underachiever category. On the China side of things, China was already an underachiever last year, and it has remained one, but it's actually improved its power gap score marginally. So something is happening there. And it's early days. We need to repeat this exercise a few times to find out if that's just a little fluctuation or if that's really a trend that's beginning to form. Japan is a fascinating case when it comes to the power gap, because it is our greatest overachiever for the second year running. And not only that, it's improved its score from last year in terms of the power gap. And Hervé's already mentioned the different reasons for this, you know, investing 1.5 times what China does in Southeast Asia, coaxing the TPP minus the U.S., and in the absence of U.S. leadership across the line, closing a huge economic agreement with the EU, the largest in the EU's history at the same time as well. And all this has taken place, I mean, think of the Tokyo Olympics just around the corner next year. So all this has taken place at the same time as Japan has faced serious challenges to its resource base. So its working age population is set to decline by 18 million people between now and 2045. And it's only a quarter the size of China's economy. So it seems to be an overachiever. And we don't know if that's sort of a historical effect, or sort of a legacy effect from its historical heyday in the 80s and the 90s, or whether as an economy it's particularly efficient at translating what it has into influence in Asia. Now, India is the sort of mirror image of what we see for Japan. So if you recall, on the overall power findings, they are neck and neck in terms of even the scores. But India, you'll see, is an underachiever. So a lot of India's strong showings on the overall power findings are down to the sheer scale of the country and the demographic dividends. And it does tell us, as Hervé mentioned, that Narendra Modi's Act East policy has lost some steam. A few other countries to point out. Australia is an overachiever after South Korea as well. It's slightly dropped on that front. So, again, we'll watch that one, see what happens there. And then we have the underachievers. So Taiwan, as a diplomatic outsider, is certainly an underachiever. You know, it is the fourth most productive economy that we look at, and it's a top 10 defense spender. But when it comes to its political isolation, it really is hampered. And then we have North Korea. So last year, North Korea was our single greatest underachiever. And this year, it's actually managed to go above Russia. And that, I think, is down to Kim Jong-un's sort of fast-paced summit diplomacy, which has gone from 0 to 100 with President Trump this year in Hanoi and Singapore. And then Russia sits at the bottom of our power gap, and that's really down to it being a geographic outsider, still subjected to international sanctions. And the fact that, it, you know, the resources that it has tend to be invested in Europe and in the Middle East. So if you had an index for those regions, the results could look quite different on the power gap. Yeah. And I think the whole power gap overall sort of indicates a few bigger picture trends that we're seeing that Hervé has also already touched upon. And that is, I think, the role of middle powers. So the underachievers tend to be countries with quite asymmetric power. But the overachievers are all middle powers that are showing a willingness to work together and to act multilaterally to pursue their common interests. So I think this really speaks to the critical role that middle powers will play in the changing power dynamics as they unfold.
Terrific. I'm going to open it up to the audience now. But because you mentioned Taiwan, I can't resist asking a slightly cheeky question. Did you get any protest at all from countries that shall not be named, for even including Taiwan in the power index?
Well, as a matter of fact, we take great pride in having gone to Beijing and presented our findings to government authorities and think tanks affiliated to the government, and mentioning that Taiwan was one of the countries. We think it's important, obviously, within the balance of power. So does China, by the way. I mean, they do their own internal assessments of the strengths and weaknesses of Taiwan, and it makes absolute sense that we should as well. Largely speaking, there wasn't too much of a diplomatic protest, but China, I mean, just as a technical point, is making it very difficult to make data from Taiwan accessible. So we have to actually go directly to the national authorities in Taiwan to procure a lot of the data points which otherwise are missing from international databases. So China is making life very difficult, even to do research on Taiwan. So we take great pride in having included it.
So China puts pressure on organizations
like
that
collect
this
Bank
data
and the IMF and a number of others to not include Taiwan. And so the, as a result, it's almost as if you're wiping Taiwan off from the map. You know? Yeah.
And even though we didn't get too much protest when we were meeting different counterparts in China, we did see on social media there was a bit of an upset about our inclusion of Taiwan in Chinese social media, at least. So.
Let me open it up now, and we have a first question here. Just wait for the microphone.
Denise Fisher, thank you very much. Very interesting, always look for it. I'm just very interested, one of our own assessments of our own national power and cohesion, of course, is our values, democratic principles, respect for human rights. Where, if at all, do you factor this in into your mapping survey?
So, interestingly, we don't include that as an input into the index, and that's because we try and operate more on the basis of outputs. So our assumption is that if you're a democratic country or you've got a strong rule of law or you know, low corruption, that will show in the results as opposed to putting it as an input. So we haven't actually endeavored to include it as an indicator. But what I would say as well is that you find most of those countries that fall, for example, in the overachiever category do much better on those particular metrics. But yeah, we didn't want to say that one system of doing your affairs is better than another. So we don't want to say that you can only be powerful if you're a democracy. And we see a lot of authoritarian countries which can be very powerful without democratic values. Even corruption can sort of lubricate the wheels of the economy in small doses. So we didn't want to draw those causal links. But I think you can overlay that to the results that we now have and find correlations. And I think there are a lot of correlations to be drawn.
Yeah, it actually plays a role in our assessment of institutional stability. The fact is, if you look at China's security spending, or even if you asked in a frank moment a Chinese policymaker how they would configure the biggest security threats to China's stability, the United States might not even be the top of the list. Mm-hmm. It would be Tibet, or it would be Xinjiang, or it would be human rights protesters in Hong Kong. And so that is an enormous distraction and a drain on resources for China to try to maintain a degree of control. And what we look at is civil unrest. So we look at in the last 5 years, how many recorded incidents of violent protests have there been? We look at internal conflicts as well. So countries like Myanmar, Tatmadaw, Myanmar's military, is one of the biggest in Asia, 500,000 people, but is entirely configured to deal with internal threats, the ethnic minority groups that are fighting the central government. So the point is, if you're weak in that sense, if you're incapable of governing your country in a stable manner, you're also, potentially as a smaller country, inviting foreign influence. Now, the opposite is true for countries with very strong institutions, strong rule of law. Australia is a case in point. We've got incredibly strong institutions that are capable of reacting to foreign influence threats. We can amend our laws. We can shore up our resilience in that sense. I think that's something that there's a huge benefit, albeit a secondary sense. But I think it is a huge benefit. So indirectly, as Bonnie was saying, I think countries with a strong rule of law, good governance, tend to be those that perform the best, certainly in terms of broad-based multilateralism.
Thanks very much, Ben Coleman. Again, terrific presentation again. Just on influence, that appears in a couple of areas of your measures there, and I'm just wondering how you determine, how you make your judgments about influence.
We consider influence in a variety of ways. In terms of defense diplomacy, so how many allies have you got? How many joint training exercises do you undertake with other countries in the region as a sign of trust as well? Your cultural exports of cultural goods and services as a sign of the kind of traction that Australia might have. For example, the education, first-rate education that Australia provides in the region. It's the second most popular university destination behind the United States for Asian students.
a lot of Southeast Asian leaders have been educated in our institutions. And that is a version of influence as well that we exercise. And then there's economic influence. So free trade agreements are often, they're sort of statements of ambition to want to do more, integrate ourselves more with like-minded partners. But that's also a form of concrete influence. What else have we got? I mean, we've got plenty of things going for us in terms of how we track influence. But essentially what we're looking at is the depth and the variety and the diversity of relationships that every country has within our region. And that's how we come up with our assessment of countries being particularly influential in relation to their size or actually lacking influence in relation to their size.
And just to sort of the sort of model that we came up with the power gap is actually based on some readings that we did and this idea of sort of power conversion. So Professor Joe Nye of Harvard is actually sort of the father of soft power as a term and all that. And he had this idea that you can have power, but do you have the ability to convert that power into the outcomes that you want? And that's kind of what we're trying to get at with our power gap as well. So not assuming that having resources means that you are translating it into outcomes.
Thank you. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how your index captures the complexities of great powers who wield their influence in a coercive way. So I'm thinking of China has great naval military power, but it's used it to pressure or intimidate small powers like Malaysia and Vietnam this week and this month, or the United States with its tradition of promoting free trade and global markets, but it's the Trump administration has been very quick to use tariffs and economic coercion to sort of set the agenda of international trade. How do you capture that sort of two steps forward, one step back, or one step forward, two steps back, depending on how you read it? Thank you.
It's a good question, and Hervé, when you answer it, it's also worth mentioning that the growth of Chinese naval power has been pretty well documented, but perhaps less documented is the fact that they've built, if anything, the growth in China's, constabulary naval power has grown even further. The Coast Guard has been just explosive growth. Does the Power Index track all of that as well?
We actually look at merchant fleets as well. So that's where we see that China actually does very well. But, you know, you're talking about gray zone tactics and influence. And I think one of the characteristics of great power relations as it stands, and in the Indo-Pacific in particular, is that power politics takes place below the threshold of conflict. And that makes it hard to respond to. It also makes it hard to track as a research undertaking. But almost by nature, a lot of these coercive tactics take place behind closed doors in ways that are hard to discern. One of the ways that we're trying to track how China may have cajoled certain countries into voting its way on the South China Sea, for example, or other particularly sensitive issues at the UN, is by looking at UN voting patterns. Other ways, I would say, is that there are telltale signs of coercive as opposed to persuasive influence. Coercive influence tends to be more fickle. It tends to be that you can win over, you can strong arm a smaller country on a particular issue, but it doesn't mean that they commit allegiance to you wholesale. And I think Malaysia and Vietnam are prime examples of having to concede on certain fronts and in other ways trying to counterbalance China as much as they can by investing doubly so in terms of their defense diplomacy with countries like Australia and Indonesia and Japan. So we're seeing kind of hedging tactics, which I think is also a telltale sign. But I think the other thing that we have to keep in mind is that we have to own up to the fact that China's status is being normalized in our region despite much more criticism coming from Western countries in particular. Its economic diplomacy does seem to be popular, at least its emphasis on infrastructure. And when you look at China's ownership over the multilateral development multilateral architecture of our region through initiatives like the AIIB, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, or the BRI, well, it has had traction. So not all of China's influence is coercive. I think we have to own up to the idea that actually some of what it's doing is genuinely popular and gaining traction. And that's also why we see that China's improved on its power gap score, although it remains an underachiever. So we'll have to monitor that.
We've got time for one or two more. Charlie.
Hey, Hervé, you mentioned that short of war, the United States is unlikely to halt China's long march to overtaking the United States as the world's largest economy. How do you expect high-intensity conflict between the U.S. and China to affect both economies, should it emerge?
Yeah, that's a very big question. Just to qualify that first point, I think it's unlikely that the U.S. will be able to halt China's continued rise. I think China is likely to be able to level the United States within our region, not necessarily globally. And that doesn't mean that China will replace the United States as a unipolar power, because I think it would be very difficult for China to establish undisputed primacy in the way that Hugh White often talks about. I don't think China will simply replace the U.S., but I do think we're talking about a leveling playing field. Secondly, I think, yes, in the event of conflict, outright conflict, the United States, with its conventional military strength, also with its defense networks, still has a commanding military advantage if war breaks out in the short term. And if it's committed to fighting that war, then a commitment is a big word there. One of the stranger characteristics of China's rise as a military power is that as a percentage of GDP, its defense spending has remained more or less level at 1.9%. And so we've done some modeling of what China's military rise would look like if it decided to ramp up its defense spending as a percent of GDP to something closer to the United States, around 3.6%, or even higher, if there is a period of intensifying competition, rivalry, tensions, that you see both the U.S. and China committing to a long-term military struggle, that both powers could ramp up their defense spending as a percent of GDP. And that's where we see something quite scary, which is that China would start to level the U.S. in terms of defense spending by 2030. But for the moment, under business as usual, let me just show you the defense resources of the United States in 2030 remain larger than China's. And so we think the U.S. remains the dominant military player at least until 2030. How that changes in a situation of war, a lot of variables to predict, so I'm not going to make that guess.
Thank you. We've got time for one more question.
Thank you. John Hemphill. One of the marvelous tools, if we did a hypothetical, if one were an Australian defence planner or economic planner, how would one use this tool to develop strategies and policies which would better position Australia in the future?
That's a great concluding question, actually. Yeah. So I think there's a number of specific policy recommendations that we've already made. One is keeping in mind that we're talking, about power politics beneath the threshold of conflict, so we need to invest in our defense capability for certain. But we also need to think about our geoeconomic security, the fact that economic asymmetries might be exploited for geopolitical gain, and we need to consider what that means in terms of our economic relationship with China. But I would qualify that by saying, yes, we do trade a lot with China, but our trade-to-GDP ratio is actually a lot healthier than most Asian tiger economies, who, if you then consider that factor, are much more dependent, much more vulnerable potentially in headwinds or disruptions in global trade, and disruptions in particular with China. So China exercises less leverage than we often assume on that front. Where I would flag some degree of alarm is in terms of our energy security. I think we could very easily establish a national fuel reserve. I think that makes imminent sense. We've just had an attack on a Japanese tanker a few weeks ago off the shore of Iran. That's exactly the kind of incident magnified that would very quickly compromise our energy security because of our dependence, higher than any other country in Asia, on imports of refined fuel. So that also makes sense in terms of decarbonization. That's not just a soft, benign, let's tackle climate change. I think climate change is huge, but also because it enhances our autonomy. It's exactly what China is doing. They're investing in renewables because it enhances their autonomy, their self-dependence. I think Australia has a much bigger role to play in terms of our role in the supply chains of critical minerals, which are used in technology, renewables as well as digital technologies. At the moment, we produce about 15% of the global supply of rare earth minerals. Now, rare is a misnomer in this case because we've got the reserves, we just don't exploit them enough. And this is another area where China could use an asymmetric advantage to leverage other countries. This is one area where Australia has an enormous comparative advantage. And then finally, I would just urge, as a point of principle, policymakers not to view themselves as collateral damage or passive observers of geopolitics in Asia. We can make a difference in terms of the overall balance of power. And if we work with like-minded partners, we really do actually shape the course of geopolitics within our region.
And I think the power gap in particular speaks to how it's almost like a report card for how policymakers are performing. And if they're overachieving, that means they must be doing something probably right. But the fact that Australia has ever so slightly dipped since last year tells me that's something that we're going to have to watch and that I'm sure policymakers will be interested to find out in Canberra.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've run out of time. Could I ask you to please put your hands together and thank Bonnie and Herbert?